the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
We're joined by Rosemary Hennigan for today's Culture Club. Her new novel is The Hotel Guest. And before I get to all your Culture Club choices, Rosemary, this, your third novel, tell us what it's all about, please.
I will. So it is about a character called Kit Costigan, who is a young waitress, and she's working in a hotel in the French Alps on a beautiful lake. And when she's there, she falls in with a group of guests at the hotel who are these philosophy researchers, and they're kind of living their philosophy in a way and kind of experimenting with that, which sounds kind of glamorous and exciting to Kit at first, but it ultimately ends in tragedy. They leave, they part ways, and then 10 years later, she gets a note out of the blue telling her she has to return to the hotel. That's all I can say without leaving any spoilers. So, yeah, that's it.
Okay, is this based maybe, did you do something like this as a college student, go away and do work in a summer someplace like this?
I did, not quite in France. I was just on holidays there and kind of inspired by what was happening around me on this hotel terrace. But I did, yes, spend time away. I went on J1 to New York. It's a little bit of a different experience, but I did draw on a lot of that for the story.
Because you have an interesting background before turning to writing novels as a lawyer and then working as well in the charity sector. So tell us about your progression there. What's motivated that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interest in the world around me primarily and in ways in which we live together. I think novels are often kind of, you know, one aspect of how we all kind of coexist and the little dramas that come out. And the law is when that thing breaks down, you know, when you get to the extremes and you're trying to kind of resolve disputes or find better ways to live together, which is what my work was in the charity sector. It was kind of on the policy and research side. So it was around, you know, how can we kind of reform the law to maybe get better outcomes?
How long did you work in law for?
So I was 3 to 4 years in a law firm, and then I was about 5 years maybe in the charity sector, and I was writing novels on the side. So it's been kind of, the two things went hand in hand for a long time.
Okay. And are you full-time writing now?
I am, yeah, for the moment anyway, which is nice.
What do you mean for the moment now anyway?
Well, you never know. It's the nature of a creative career, you know, and I think as well, it's always, there's always something that kind of draws you back towards that policy work because it's very impactful, you know. It's kind of, it's something that I think I'll always be interested in. So I kind of want to keep them in tandem.
Do you think, is it important to people in the creative arts and writers not to spend their whole life writing, but to actually have had experience of things like law and the charity sector as you've had? I mean, it could be various other different things, but to have that experience of life.
I do. For me personally, I don't think I could write if I wasn't drawing on those kind of things. It's being out in the world and being kind of interested and curious about the world around you and people and how we coexist. I think a lot of that is what I bring to my novels, but I definitely wanted, especially when I was younger, I really wanted to be out in the world, seeing how things worked, getting involved, being in the room where the decisions were made. And I think that's why I kind of draw on those themes in a lot of my novels.
Okay, let's go to all your choices and see what's informed you. We always start with music, and we always ask for a first single you've ever bought. You might be a bit young for the singles here. Is there a single there?
There is a single there, yeah, just about. I do remember the switch over to streaming and kind of starting out with all the pirating, you know, the LimeWire and all of that kind of stuff. But before that, there were singles. And the first one I ever bought was Pure Shores by All Saints. And the reason for that was, I mean, it's a great song. It's a great bop. But I, before that, probably stole a lot of my music from my teenage brothers. And so a lot of my musical taste reflects their taste. And this was the first time where I kind of said, come on, you know, this is a great song. And they went, absolutely not. And so I had to go.
Why, what were they listening to at that stage?
They were into Radiohead and Smashing Pumpkins and Blur and Oasis. And
good 1990s music.
Absolutely. And as a result, so was I. So it was kind of an unusual taste for a child of the 90s, a girl in the 90s. All of my friends were into, you know, Spice Girls and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, well, what about Radiohead? So it was a bit strange. But Pure Shores was kind of my own first kind of single where I said, no, do you know what? I'm buying this myself. If you're not going to buy it, I will.
Let's hear a little bit of All Saints.
Something to call my own.
still like it?
I do, yeah. Was
it's a good pop song from nearly 30 years ago.
It is, God, 30 years ago.
Is it that far? Well, not far off that.
Yeah, about 2000, I think.
Okay, right. Okay, first, your favourite album. And this is an interesting choice because this is something you would have not from that era that you would have come to from before, well before you were born. Tell us about the Velvet Underground and Nico.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, you know, in terms of what did I mean by favourite album? How would I choose it? Would I listen to an album forever? And I thought, you know, if I was stuck listening to one album, that would be my favourite. It would probably have to be the Velvet Underground and Nico, because I think artistically it's just so free and unbounded and unexpected. The way the music rises and falls, and there's so much discordancy and so much difference from one single to the next. And you can just get the sense of people who were really enjoying creating something. And I absolutely love that feeling. It makes me think I'm living in, you know, 1967 New York. It makes me kind of nostalgic for an experience I never had. But I think there was something very special about that time. And so I think that music kind of conjures it for me.
Do you remember how you were introduced to the Velvet Underground and Nico?
I think probably my dad, who would have been kind of, you know, of that era. I think probably it was his music. So there's both my brother's influence on the music and also my dad. So you can see the different generations there coming to bear in my taste.
Well, let's hear from that eponymous 1967 album, The Velvet Underground and Nico. Let's hear a little bit of Sunday Morning.
It's just a restless feeling by my side. Early dawning, Sunday morning. It's just the wasted years so close behind. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always someone around you who will call. It's nothing at all.
Very hippie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, that's the Velvet Underground and Nico. Okay, favourite band or artist? This can often be a very difficult one for people. What have you gone for?
I went for Arcade Fire because I think their debut came out in 2004. I think it was about 15 at the time, and it was just beautiful. It had kind of the right combination of, you know, enough angst for me as a teenager and also this kind of beautiful, melodious music as well. And the combination of the two just really, really stands out for me. And then ever since, I think their albums have kind of grown on that debut. It's their band I can go back to anytime and enjoy listening to them.
Could it be that it was still the best album they did?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. It captures their kind of all of their vision and the heart of their music, I think, in that one album. They came out very strong on the first one, I suppose.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit from Funeral, Rebellion. Fire at their very best.
Absolutely, yeah.
Funeral, the album from back in 2004. Now, we're giving you two gigs. You couldn't make a decision as to which one you prefer the most. We don't have any audio, I think, from the first one. So tell us about Bell X1 at the Olympia. How far back is this?
Again, I think it was 2004. So, you know, a very crucial year, clearly, in my musical taste and development. But I think as a teenager, you really remember those moments. And it was my first time. It was myself and my friend, Emer, and we went to the Olympia Theatre. There were no parents. It was kind of our first experience of that sense of freedom that I think music can give and live performance can give. And it was just magic. They were absolutely brilliant live, but they were. It was also kind of the feeling of being in the crowd and kind of enjoying something communally. I think it was really special, and that's why I chose Ballix One for that. It was a definitive moment, I think, really.
Your other selection is much more recent, from Vicar Street in 2023, Lancome.
Yeah, I mean, they're just transformative. I think when they're playing live, it's like nothing else. It's poetic, so it's like poetry and music. And again, I think being in a crowd with that is just very special. They're kind of, when you're there, you feel as if there's this moment that you're experiencing together and it won't last. And so you're very much carried in that moment and very present in the music. They're such talented musicians, and it's such a great honour, honestly, to have seen them play live. It was brilliant.
We actually have a little bit of Lancome in concert at Vicar Street in 2023.
The boys of Liverpool, when we safely landed, called myself a fool. I could no longer stand it, blood began to boil. Temper I was losing, poor old Aaron's oil. They began abusing her, and myself says I, shillelagh, I let fly. Galway boys were boy, and saw I was a hobbling with the loud array. Joined in the affray, we quickly cleared the way for the rocky road to Dublin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road, and all the ways to Dublin, whack for I'll be
Did Lancome manage to marry modernity with old traditional music?
Yeah, I think so. They capture kind of the heart and the feeling, the shivers that you get from that kind of emotional music, but they bring it to a modern audience and they kind of involve you in it in a way that feels as if it's in conversation with other music happening at the moment. But it's a very interesting time, I think, for Irish music and for Irish folk music.
In what way?
Just, you've seen kind of, they're managing to push through, I think, what can sometimes feel like a very kind of produced and carefully created and marketed music. I think they're doing something much more interesting and much more kind of faithful to the old ways, but with a new kind of modern spin on it for new audiences.
Okay, let's move away from music now. And favourite movie, actor or director, you have given us as a movie Intermission. This hasn't come up in a while. It has come up with a few guests, not in a while.
Yeah.
Remind people of what Intermission is.
Sure. It's a film from, I think, the early 2000s, set in Dublin across the day. And it starts with this very kind of arresting scene of Colin Farrell in a cafe kind of chatting up a waitress only to mug her very violently. And so it kind of goes from there and progresses with a cast of different characters that all kind of form part of, you know, an ordinary Dublin day. And it's so funny and I think quite harsh in some ways and then quite witty in other ways. And there's a huge amount of heart to it ultimately. And I think there's something that it captures Dublin in it, I think, in that way. That's the city that I know is very much inside of Intermission. It's something that myself and my friends and my family quote to each other constantly. There's just so many great one-liners and so many unforgettable performances. So I think, once again, if I were choosing a favourite, it just has to be Intermission.
Haven't seen it in years. Must get it out again. We actually have a scene from Intermission starring Owen Rowe, who did the Culture Club not too long ago, and Cillian Murphy.
So there's a couple of jars smashed in that lane, John. Clear them up, will you?
It's not my job, it's Thomas's. He's on the brush.
Your job is to do what I tell you. Now, come on.
It's not Dolce Salsa, is it?
It is, yeah.
Can't do it, man. Dolce Salsa makes me sick. All I have to do is smell the stuff.
Move. Thomas, wait there. Hey, come. You are. Do it.
Okay, man.
You're okay, Thomas. I'm just trying to make a point. Oh, for God's sake.
OJ.
You finished? finished?
Yeah.
In our bakery,
come with me.
Thomas,
clear up that sick before someone slips in it.
I wasn't aware what the clip was before we played it there, and I apologise to anyone who's at home perhaps eating at present, given the time of evening as it is when you're listening to it. But intermission is definitely, definitely worth watching. The other one that you've picked as a favourite, The Phantom Thread, another Paul Thomas Anderson, Daniel Day-Lewis collaboration. If I remember that, that wouldn't be my favourite of the. It's so desperately slow.
It's very slow, but it has that suspense running through it. So the entire time you feel this sense that at any moment Daniel Day-Lewis's character is going to snap. And it's a question of when. And I think if you've ever been around someone with that kind of tension inside themselves, it just creates a sense of dread. And for me, in terms of the type of novels I write, it's the same sort of suspense where you're like, is he going to explode? What's going to send him off? What are the other characters going to do that just pushes him over the edge? And so that's what gets me through it. But it's also just the beauty of it as well. You know, it's an incredibly beautiful and well put together film that comes to such a satisfying ending in terms of that kind of build up that there is between the two characters at the centre of it. It ends in, I think, a very iconic way involving the preparation of an omelette and the addition of mushrooms to it. So it is... to me, it is kind of a perfect film because it combines that suspense and that drama between people with the kind of beauty and cinematography and that real question of kind of psychological suspense where they're pulled so tight that you feel at any moment it's gonna go.
Yeah, and you have one other you want to mention. It's one that I actually watched again only a few weeks ago because I enjoy it so much. The Royal Tenenbaums.
It's so great. I watch it a lot. I think it's well worth a rewatch.
Why for you?
I think the first time I watched it, I had absolutely no sympathy for Gene Hackman's character, for Royal Tenenbaum himself. And the more I've watched it, the more he's grown on me. And I think he's actually the most interesting character of them all because he's this kind of lovable rogue who is mostly rogue when you first encounter him. But what you realise is there's something warm and kind of impossible about how annoying he is and how bad he is and how selfish he is. And I think those characters are just so compelling, really, as kind of a piece of drama. And again, it's just stylistically very entertaining and very compelling. You can't help but watch it in that kind of Wes Anderson style. It just grabs you.
Full of ridiculous set pieces, but yes. Yet they actually work.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of bordering on cartoonish, but in a way that I think works really well.
Okay, let's move to plays, theatre shows, musical. What do you got for us here?
Yeah, so during COVID, the Abbey Theatre put on this production of Patrick Kavanagh's The Great Hunger on the grounds of Imma. And it was just the most spectacular thing I've seen. Basically, we were brought in small groups and walked through the grounds. And at each segment of the grounds, there was another actor with another piece of the poem that they would kind of perform for this small group. And it was just magical. I know it was partly that we were all under lockdown, so there were all of those kind of conditions to it. But it was a really special way of taking the restrictions of the lockdown and turning it into this really special moment. And I think Lisa O'Neill was in it, so there was kind of music as well. And it was just, it made me engage with the poem in a new way as well. And that poem is just, I think, a masterpiece of all of Kavanagh's work. I think it is just outstanding. There's so much heart in it, and there's so much kind of Irish culture and history and the Irish psyche that's captured in the poem. So to have it adapted so well in that way was just really spectacular.
And you have a second choice from The Peacock.
Yeah, so this is an ANIU production, which if anybody has seen it, they put on a lot of kind of immersive theatre. So they did one at Collins Barracks a couple of years ago for the First World War commemorations. And this one was about Hammam and kind of Cathal Brua's last moments. And they turned the behind the scenes of the Peacock Theatre, they turned that into the Hammam Hotel in O'Connell Street, essentially. And so you're inside while you have the sensation of kind of, you know, the battering of the hotel from the other side, essentially the other forces. And you're inside there with the actors and with the characters. And it's incredibly affecting. I know, you know, that kind of immersive theatre isn't for everyone, but I really love it. And it took that kind of moment in history and recreated it, made it live again.
OK, now, as a novelist, we asked you a very unfair question. Nominate a favourite book and a favourite author, and you just couldn't pick one. You've given us a terrific list. So tell us the type of books that you love.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. So I think the thing they have in common is probably a transportive sort of universe that they create. So when I think of these books, they're almost spaces in my mind that I can return to. So there's a door I can open, and it's Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall trilogy, and there's another door, and that's Donna Tartt's The Secret History.
Well, actually, just come back to the Wolf Hall trilogy, because I want to play a little bit from the audiobook of Wolf Hall, and this is the chapter in which Anne Boleyn is introduced.
The rumour spreads that she is going to marry Harry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland's heir. The Cardinal hauls in her father. "Sir Thomas Boleyn," he says, "speak to your daughter, or I will. We brought her back from France to marry her into Ireland, to the butler's heir. Why does she tarry?"
"The butler's, sir," Sir Thomas begins, and the Cardinal says, "Oh, yes? The butler's what? Any problem you have there, I'll fix the butler's. What I want to know is, did you put her up to it? Conniving in corners with that foolish boy. Because, Sir Thomas, let me make myself plain, I won't have it. The King won't have it. It must be stopped."
"I have scarcely been in England these last months. Your Grace cannot think that I am party to the scheme."
"No, you would be surprised what I can think. Is this your best excuse, that you can't govern your own children?"
Sir Thomas is looking wry and holding out his hands. He's on the verge of saying, "young people today," but the Cardinal stops him. The Cardinal suspects, and has confided his suspicion, that the young woman is not enticed by the prospect of Kilkenny Castle and its frugal amenities, nor by the kind of social life that will be available to her when, on special occasions, she hacks on the poor dirt roads to Dublin.
Okay, I have to admit, I haven't read the books. I love the TV series. The adaptation was absolutely magnificent. Is there a lot more in the books to enjoy beyond the television?
There is, but I mean, the TV adaptation is actually fantastic. Like, it's a really great adaptation of the books, so it's a good place to start. But if you enjoyed those, you'll really enjoy the books. There is an endless treasure trove of layers, I think, inside it. There is, you know, at once there's the political intrigue, then there's the human, there's the story of Thomas Cromwell kind of, and his almost paternal relationship with Wolsey, his mentor. And there's so many layers of the human inside that that politics and that history. So every time I go back to those books, which is fairly regularly, I discover something new, another aspect of them. So even just that piece that you just played there just contained an entire history, you know, a whole avenue you could go down and kind of discover story after story about the butlers in Kilkenny and what would have happened if Anne Boleyn had actually ended up there. And so I think Hilary Mantel is just so fantastic at drawing out those little threads and kind of hinting at other histories. So there's kind of histories inside of other histories. You could read the Wolf Hall trilogy forever, I think, and never get bored.
So other books you have Donna Tartt's The Secret History.
Yes, it's been quite a large influence on me, and I think on my writing. It's definitely a guiding light, I suppose, for the type of books I'd like to write.
Okay, another choice is the mysticism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude.
Yes, which is just, again, a story that has endless other stories, and both the kind of magical realism of it all, but also just the family dynamics and the saga of this one kind of place and time that you can kind of travel back through the ages with. And I just think he brings such an incredible imagination to that story. I think you could get lost in it.
Now, the next one we're going to play an extract from is Kevin Barry from City of Bohan.
"Whatever is wrong with us is coming in off that river. No argument. The taint of badness on the city's air is a taint off that river. This is the Bohan River we're talking about. A blackwater surge, malevolent. It roars in off the Big Knotton Wastes, and the city was spawned by it and was named for it, City of Bohan." He walked the docks and breathed in the sweet badness of the river. It was past midnight on the Bohan front. There was an evenness to his footfall, a slow, calm rhythm of leather on stone, and the dockside lamps burned in the nighttime a green haze, the light of a sad dream. The water's roar for Hartnett was as the rushing of his own blood, and as he passed the merchant yards, the guard dogs strung out a sequence of howls all along the front. See the dogs, their hackles heaped, their yellow eyes livid. We could tell he was coming by the howling of the dogs.
Kevin Barry, who has previously done a Culture Club and has been a guest many times on this programme, reading his own book. Why of his many great novels have you picked that one out?
I think, again, because it's so singular. He creates an entire universe there, even, you know, a patois and a language within that book that is so so deeply memorable. I like, I think maybe it's the lawyer in me, but I always like books that kind of create these micro societies and these dynamics within them where you can kind of see, you know, the real world to kind of play itself out in that fictional way. And I think he does it so brilliantly in The City of Bohem. And it's so deeply atmospheric and kind of in that way, that kind of gritty city urban feeling that you get is, I'll never forget it. Having read it at least twice, I probably should read it a third time now. I'm inspired by that clip.
Give us some more of your favourite books.
Well, another I want to mention is The Master and Margarita, which, again, I will return to again and again. It's utterly surprised me. I think it was a book I went into having had lots of people tell me that it was one of the books, best books they've ever read. And I had no idea it was going to go off on the pathways that it did. It's about three different stories all meshed into one. And it just kept surprising me. And I love being surprised by a book like that. And then also Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, which I know isn't for everyone, but I would strongly recommend it. It is, it's set in kind of the 1300s in medieval monastery in Italy, but it's also a murder mystery around kind of the death of a monk in this monastery. And I just, again, it just filled my mind with ideas and with different kind of worlds all within it.
Again, the movie, which I think was Christian Slater's, and maybe an easier introduction, the book can be tough going.
It can be, but I think just take your time with it and just enjoy it. Take it easy.
Television. Are you much into television?
I am, yeah. I would say recently I'm very into The Pitt, which I haven't put on that list, but which I have to mention because
it's magnificent.
It's so good. I'm telling everyone. And I'm not even a medical drama kind of person, but it's just got me. It's so great. I just finished the second season and I'm screaming it from the rooftops. Everyone should watch it.
And you have other choices, like traditional ones like The West Wing, Succession and Peep Show. Yes. But tell us about Fish Police.
So this is a strange one now. I will admit it's a strange one. But I was thinking about the kind of TV shows that I used to watch as a child and a teenager. I was trying to think about them by reference to my writing and by, you know, those kind of influences and where they came from. And I thought of Fish Police mainly because I don't know what I was doing watching it as a child. I don't even think it was intended for children, but I was watching it nonetheless. And it's about a bunch of fish detectives who are chasing down the fish mafia in a fish city under the water. And I absolutely loved it. I think I felt very grown up. It was gritty. It was exciting. It was like nothing else I watched as a child other than the fact that it was a cartoon. And so, again, it's one of those things where I'm constantly trying to tell people to go watch it.
Well, it has John Ritter, Ed Asner, Tim Curry, Megan Mullally doing the voices, and Joe Beth Williams. Let's hear a clip.
Who's the bats, boss?
Some new hotshot cop in town. Inspector Gill's bad enough, but at least he's predictable. I hate not knowing something.
Don't worry, boss. You get used to it.
You don't have a brass plaque on this one, do you?
Hey, Thermidor, my drink is watered down. It's water brains like him who give us crustaceans a bad name. Hey, isn't that the sharp-looking bass who popped his keister on your stool at Piles this morning?
My new partner. Charming, isn't he? Check out the threads.
Yeah, where's he get all the clams?
I don't know yet, but I'm gonna see what I can dig up.
Hey, Inkblood, you got any skinny for sale?
No, but I have Fatso here on the payroll. And if you don't get your filthy fins off me, I'll have him on you.
Yeah, right.
Okay, spread them. All 10 of them.
Nobody talks like that to the boss.
Don't get sore, Muscles.
Does your friend have any idea who I am?
No introductions necessary. I recognize your kind.
This is Calamari. He owns the joint.
Sorry, my mistake. Let me buy you a drink.
How kind. Why don't you make it a round for the house?
Fish Police.
I bet nobody's ever chosen that before.
No, they haven't. Okay. Listen, just finish for us, please. We're nearly out of time. We ask everyone for a buried treasure, something that people should know a lot more about. And you've gone for a really interesting choice.
Yeah. So this is St. Mary's Abbey, which is about 5 minutes from from Mary Street, I suppose, right beside the Lewis Drop, just there. And it's under the ground, about 2 feet down. And a lot of people don't know about it, especially lifelong Dubliners. I happened to find it when I was researching another novel idea, which may or may not ever appear, about Silk and Thomas. And it led me down to the discovery of the chapter house of St. Mary's Abbey, which was where he declared his rebellion back in 1536, I think.
Silken Thomas Fitzgerald.
Thomas Fitzgerald, exactly, who Anne Boleyn might have known if she had gotten married and moved to Ireland. So it all goes together. And I think it probably was in part my love of Wolf Hall that actually led me down towards Silken Thomas and then to St. Mary's Abbey. But it's just this remarkable place. It was where the Privy Council used to meet in Ireland. It's where Thomas Fitzgerald threw down the Sword of State, declared his rebellion. And it was also the chapter house of this enormously powerful and important Cistercian monastery. And I've said it to so many people and people don't really know it's there. And so in terms of buried treasure, I thought, well, look, I'll mention that and see if more people go. There's a brilliant OPW tour.
Great choice. Rosemary Hennigan, thank you so much for being with us. The Hotel Guest is your new novel.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.